Our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here. Let me guess, we're going to be talking about a bridge.
Yeah.
That's Simon and Garfunkel.
No. Yes. The 1913 Salmon Bay Railroad Bridge is not going to be demolished. It is going to be renovated, even though it is something of a relic. So you decided to investigate this. By the way, Felix is brought to you by the King County Library System.
Yeah, if you've ever been to the Ballard Locks and looked to the west, you've seen this distinctive railroad drawbridge. It's got this huge million-pound counterweight at one end. It was built by the Great Northern Railway 107 years ago. And the successor, BNSF, announced last month that rather than completely replace it, which would have been a major loss of a visual landmark, they're going to renovate it and keep it looking mostly the same. Now, one cool aspect of the old bridge is that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, an operator is on duty inside a little 10-by-15-foot shack on the northeast side of the bridge. One of the operators who's been there for many years is Butch Elsasser.
I'm able to view the entire structure of the bridge trestle as it spans the Salmon Bay Canal, and the views of the trains coming into sight from the south end, and I also can look north and see the trains coming from the other direction.
Yeah, it's this cool little perch. And, you know, Butch grew up in Seattle. Like a lot of kids, he had model trains. He liked to watch real trains going by. When he first got a job with a railroad as a young man, he didn't think it would be a career. That was 46 years ago. He clearly loves his job. He's, you know, in communication with radio, with the Coast Guard and with train dispatchers along the line to manage his share of the 30 to 40 train crossings that happen each day and all the boats and stuff going underneath. The most trains he's ever seen on a single shift was 22. For the trains that do pass, many of which are crewed by people he's known for a long time, Butch has a special way of greeting them when they pass by.
Believe it or not, I actually have this great big white glove that looks kind of like a Mickey Mouse glove, you know, big white hand. And so as they come around the bend from the south end of the bridge, and they come into sight, I give them this great big wave back and forth.
And we'll post pictures of that later because he has this giant white hand that makes it look... I'm sure the people have never seen it before when they see him leaning out of the bridge shack there. Now, the perch up there in the shack in the drawbridge gives Butch a unique viewpoint for sea lions, for birds, flocks of geese that fly under the bridge, for sunsets and that sort of thing. Most of the time, it's actually a pretty quiet place. That changes when a train is passing.
The bridge itself kind of comes alive. You get the... vibration of all of the tonnage on steel wheels, on steel rails, and the place, shakes and shimmies, and then there's the clickety-clack of the steel reels on the rail joints.
He finds that charming, I guess, huh?
And I wasn't able to visit the operator shack because of the pandemic, but I asked Butch to record the sound of a train passing. Let's hear a little bit of this.
Okay.
So you get that 22 times a day if you're Butch.
Yeah.
Now, the mechanism that raises and lowers the drawbridge span, that's what BNSF is replacing as part of the renovation. They did that once before, about 20 years ago. Now, Butch has been around long enough to remember the old original 1913 drawbridge mechanism that moved it up and down, you know, this huge million-pound counterweight, had a bunch of gears, and they required a lot of maintenance.
We used to go up there and grease them. It was a two-man job. You have somebody run the bridge down below, and then the other person up above would paint grease on the gears as it was running at a real slow maintenance speed. And standing in there amongst all those gears was very fascinating. I felt like a shrinking man inside a watch piece.
Yeah. It's crazy. There aren't too many jobs like this left. I used to remember the elevator operators in the Smith Tower.
Right.
And there's a few other drawbridges like this in the BNSF system. But, and I spent a lot of time talking to Butch. And, you know, he clearly loves his job. He was telling me about all the different wildlife, the birds, and the different, you know, the variations, what it's like to be there during a windstorm or a snowstorm. There was one time where he went out there. He was sweeping the snow off the bridge in a very windy storm, and a gust came and took the broom out of his hands and blew it all the way towards the locks, like went sailing out across the water. Now, along with the animals and the sunsets and the boats and the trains, I asked Butch Elsasser if he gets to see a sort of, I don't know, sort of a parade of humanity from his unique perch on the Salmon Bay drawbridge.
Oh, yes. People don't, they're just not aware of bridge being up here and maybe possibly having somebody in the shack. So I've seen, I'm not going to say everything, but just about. I mean, I've seen a lot of activities. With people. I call them the other side of the wildlife.
Well, the thing looks abandoned. I mean, the times I've been there, I assume that it, I've seen a train pass a couple times, so I guess I know, you know, in my mind that it's actually working. But if you're there and the thing is up, because they keep it up most of the time, it just looks like it's sitting there as a landmark.
No, Butch is there. He's watching, Dave.
Wow.
Butch is watching us.
Well, I know that now.
Now, BNSF told me Monday there's no date that's been set yet for the bridge renovation work to begin. One of the reasons they're doing it, they're going to save about $50 million by not replacing the bridge. And I really like the fact they're keeping this visual landmark, because standing there at the locks, all the pictures going back 100 years, that bridge is just always right there in the, you know, in the middle of the scene.
Are they
at
least going to paint it a more interesting color?
That didn't come up in our conversation. I'll have to check on that one. So,
yeah. All right. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
I know the story behind the bridge, and that the bridge, even though they look abandoned, is watching you all the time, along with everything else.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. These stories have shown that one by one, each person can make a difference, even with small acts of kindness. With that being true, imagine what large companies can do by inspiring employees into those acts of kindness. Bonneville, which owns our radio station, they give us paid time off to volunteer. They will match donations. And Bonneville's not alone in that effort. Microsoft matches its employees' donations, too. The company's employee giving campaign was started by Bill Gates back in 1983.
It was motivated by Bill's mother, Mary, and Bill Sr. suggested that, hey, you know what, if a company so successful as Microsoft should have a broader responsibility than just making software. And since that day, every single year, employees have given.
Rich Kaplan has worked with the company for more than 30 years, and he says employees can choose any nonprofit they'd like to support.
Microsoft matches every dollar up to $15,000 a year. And in fact, volunteer hours are matched at $25 an hour. Really, it's a call to action to employees to say, go work on the thing that you're passionate about.
Rich puts his donations towards Fred Hutchison Cancer Research Center. Today, he and his wife, Carmen, even co-chair the Fred Hutch Board of Ambassadors. His colleagues describe the ambassadors as the volunteer hype squad. Rich's passion for the Hutch comes from personal experience.
About 15 years ago, I discovered that I had a complex, rare autoimmune disease.
He was told he had a 50-50 chance of dying.
And a researcher at Fred Hutch came up with a chemotherapy drug that had some experimental treatment used with people that have something similar to me. And a doctor decided that, you know what, I was in trouble, and they should take a risk and try this new drug on me. And that new drug, a chemotherapy, saved my life.
Rich was the first human patient ever to receive that treatment.
At the Hutch, they call that fearless science. In other words, taking risks, right, when necessary to help save lives.
Just last year, close to 1,000 Microsoft employees gave to Fred Hutch. And it's estimated, since the giving campaign started nearly 40 years ago, it has helped thousands of people.
This year marks the fact that Microsoft and its employees have given $2 billion to philanthropic efforts over that period of time.
In 2020, there's a huge focus on medical research for COVID, but he says cancer is still one of the world's toughest problems to solve.
40% of people will be impacted by cancer at some point in their life.
15 years after being told he was on the verge of dying, he's trying to get the most out of living now by giving to others.
Great story. Direct from the Gianissimo Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here is G. Scott.
Sean Connery. Yeah.
What?
Bro, you ain't been on Twitter? Colleen put you on blast, man.
I didn't put him on blast.
Actually, you look just like him.
I sent you this picture through text, Dave, of you and Sean Connery looking alike.
Oh, really?
Did you get my text?
I don't know.
Dave, wait a minute. Did your voice, did it get lower when you said, oh, really?
I don't think so.
Isn't he a dead ringer, though, for Sean Connery?
Yes, he is.
You
are Sean Connery. Dave, I just want you to know that every time I come on here, love you. I love when you intro me, man. It's like,
And I love to intro you because, you see, I've always wanted to be Don Pardo, but it didn't work out. And so now I
introduce you.
You're
Dave Ross, man.
Yeah, that's right.
What's
going on? So, look, I was going to ask you about your Thanksgiving plans because we're going to visit the granddaughter in West Virginia, as we've done twice before, safely, and we think we can do it safely.
Fam, look, stop right there. Stop right there. Do not do what happened to me. I flew Frontier Airlines, and Colleen, I don't know if that's a sponsor violation, but I flew Frontier Airlines, and I'm going to tell you right now, I went and took a COVID test yesterday. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go take a COVID test on Friday. Yeah. I'm going to keep taking COVID tests because you're all on top of each other on that airline. Yes. I had no idea. In my opinion, if you're going to click purchase before you go, there should be some kind of disclaimer or warning. Hey, just so you know that you could be sitting next to everybody on the plane. And that's exactly what happened.
So now, how long ago was this?
What? Monday.
It was Monday. And you've tested negative?
I don't know. I went to go test yesterday.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to go test again. So I think my results will probably be in tomorrow or Friday-ish.
Well, I'm flying Alaska. Last time I flew Alaska.
The best.
They kept the center seats open, and I felt really good, and you know, we had no problem.
Gee, come on now. The disclaimer is Frontier Airlines. Come on, man.
Sully.
Okay. Wait, no. Okay, guys, what had happened was I had to go see my son. So I had to work late Friday night, and I had to work all the way up in Bellingham, and I didn't get done up there until 8:30. So then I had to get all the way down to SeaTac. So I had to get a flight out then. And so the package they gave me, I didn't really pay attention to the return trip, and the return trip was Frontier. I was like, huh, okay, no big deal. I've never flown them before. Well, I'm telling you right now, I have. Now, let me ask this question to you guys. Yes. When is the last time that you've been flying on a flight and you actually saw the captain come out of his pit? When was the last
time? Long time.
Oof, yeah.
I saw the dudes come out twice. I'm like, I don't know if he got bubble guts or what, but I ain't used to seeing the pilot come out there.
Their own toilet out in the cockpit?
That's what I'm saying. On Frontier, you see the guy come out.
He's got to use the toilet in the back. What's he supposed to do?
I don't know, but I'm just not used to seeing him. Not since 9/11.
So you feel safe flying, Dave? You think you're going to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Please wear a bubble suit or something.
No, I've got the surgical mask thing. I've got gloves. I've got everything.
Okay, good. Yeah. Just wrap yourself up real good. I can't lose, Dave.
Anyway.
Jeez, Colleen.
I'll
enough
worry
about
for
me.
You. No, it's a serious thing when we're in the middle of a pandemic.
But did you go all the way to lose, Dolly? We can't lose, Dave. Like, come on.
Yeah, I go there. Sure.
Sometimes I do just wander off. Anyway. So what are you going to do? Are you going to have a Thanksgiving celebration?
No. All those plans have been zapped. So here's the plan. So I just went to Columbus to see my son. And by the way, I could not hug my son or anything like that. I could not visit. I saw him outside, standing outside, talking to him a far distance away. The plan was for me to go back out there. I am going back out to Columbus next weekend, and then I was going to stay all the way through Thanksgiving and stay in Chicago and all that stuff. But that's been zapped. I mean, those plans, it's unfortunate. And I mean, I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I'm feeling sorry for us as a country that we're going through this, that some of us won't be able to see loved ones during this Thanksgiving. So, yeah, plans are zapped, man.
All right. We'll just keep getting tested.
That's it. And make sure nothing happens to you. Colleen wants nothing to happen to you, Dave.
I understand.
Stay safe. Keep the beard safe. Don't let anybody touch it.
Oh, yeah. Wait. One last thing. What you going to do with that beard, fam? Are you going to put it all?
I'm wearing it,
man. It's going to go all the way in the
beard. I find that people keep their distance voluntarily when they see me approaching this thing.
Nice. Nice.
It goes the other way.
See you guys.
Policing and participatory budgeting. That was a big part of the Seattle City Council's focus as it began sifting through its changes to the mayor's 2021 budget yesterday. With the update, here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
There's still a lot of work to do before the council wraps up its budget work over the next 2 weeks. But one thing Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda wanted to make clear yesterday.
This is the first year that the city council is not expanding the Seattle Police Department's budget. And that's in large part due to the racial reckoning that's happening, the civil rights uprising, and the ongoing call for action.
When Mosqueda released her package of changes to the mayor's spending plan this week, it was not quite as dramatic as far as cuts to SPD we had heard about. 50% cuts that were central to the discussion over the summer were not in the plan. Some council members frustrated, including Tammy Morales.
My office supports these budget actions and is exploring additional ones. And I have to be honest and transparent with my constituents. We will not reach our shared goal of 50% reduction in one budget cycle.
Mosqueda gets the frustration.
If there's frustration that this is not moving fast enough, we understand that. And we are also frustrated about some of the roadblocks that are working actively, as the council members have talked about, actively to try to address some of those roadblocks. And we will keep working with all of you as we work towards a more just and equitable public safety model in this city.
But what is in the plan amounts to about a 20% reduction by the time 911 and parking enforcement is shifted out of the SPD. And the council's plan that blocks SPD from replacing officers lost to attrition. At the same time, the council's plan strips $70 million from the mayor's $100 million investments in communities of color plan and uses a chunk to cover the cost of those communities of color taking part in participatory budgeting, something we will see include likely recommendations that eventually lead to 50% cuts at SPD, though that won't likely happen until next year.
Okay, Hannah, the $30 million still to be handed out to these community organizations. Who decides who gets it?
The city council does. I believe it's going directly to those who were already doing the research on their own for free before the money was even put aside for them. And that is King County Equity Now, Black Brilliance Research Project is, I believe, what it's called. So they've been doing this ongoing since the protests began and had been promised by the council in the over the summer budget discussions that they would get more money. So that's what's happening now, and they will continue to work on those budgets.
So what exactly do they do with that money? Is this research money, or does it invest in businesses, or do we know?
Yes, it's a part of that entire event research that they do. So they research the other options that they will want to throw out to the council as part of the next year's budget that will include different ways of doing public safety. What does that look like? We don't know yet, but they're looking into those options. And then it also includes all of the community engagement that they're doing in their own community. So they don't want it just to be their voices. All of the communities of color, they're going to try to interact with them. So it all goes into that.
All right, Car Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Well, I've said it I don't know how many times, but I have to say it again. COVID infection numbers are increasing all over the country, and that includes here in Washington State. So Cairo's Aaron Granillo and I spoke with Dr. Stephen Anderson, who has been monitoring the pressure that local hospitals are facing.
Hospitals around our state are preparing for a potential flood of new COVID patients. If the models hold up, nurses and doctors here could be stretched thin early next year.
Let's talk with Dr. Stephen Anderson. He's a 35-year veteran ER physician at Auburn Regional Medical Center, also the past chair of the board of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Thanks for talking to us today. And we've heard these warnings about overflowing hospitals at the start of the pandemic. It never happened here, even though we built the emergency tents and everything. Is this wave going to be any different?
Well, we got close in the spring, but the next wave is definitely here, and it's larger than the first wave. What we saw in New York City, we're now seeing in Iowa and in Utah. Hospitals statewide there have run out of beds. Hospitals in South King County, where I work, are already functioning nearly 100% capacity on a daily basis already. Classically, as we enter November through February, cold weather drives us indoors, flu season's upon us. Hospitals frequently run in Puget Sound area close to capacity around this time. But when you add on a disease that's as serious as COVID, the stress that we're about to see is definitely going to go up. Death rates really haven't risen a lot recently in comparison to the number of cases we're seeing, But that's partly because we're just testing a whole lot more. People are still dying from this. In fact, if you're admitted to an ICU, you have a 30% mortality. This is really serious.
Now, why is it so bad in Auburn, where you're based? It seems to be one of the worst spots in King County.
Don't take my opening sentence the wrong way, but this disease is racist. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. It's not genetic, but there's a horrifying disparity between racial demographics, mostly due to longstanding variations in policies and economics. People of color frequently live in closer proximity. They have jobs in the service industry that won't let them work from home. They have decreased access to health care for all those risk factors like COPD, obesity, hypertension, diabetes. And when you roll that all together, that's sort of Auburn. That's Federal Way. There's, for instance, a tenfold difference in the incidence of COVID in Pacific Islanders over Caucasians, sixfold in Hispanic, fourfold in Blacks. So given the fact that that population is higher incidence in South King County, it's why that we're seeing a lot of disparities down in my neck of the woods. I really, really want to see every single person in public that I pass wearing a mask. That's paramount.
That's the problem. The people are not wearing masks there.
Well, it's partly the fact that their environments, like I said, service industries, sometimes they have to be closer than 6 feet, although we'd like to keep people 6 feet apart. But the masks definitely significantly decrease transmission from coughing and sneezing and speaking and singing and all those things. And we know that that is far and away the number one mode of transmission.
You know, Dr. Aronson, when we first spoke about COVID in March and April, I remember you called it the most anxiety-provoking situation in your 35-year career. Is that still true today?
Could I tell you that in some ways, this particular week, it may even be higher than when we spoke earlier. In the back of my mind, I'm still worried about personal protective equipment. In the back of my mind, I'm always worried about beds. But this is our busiest season, November through February. And it correlates, obviously, with being indoors. Social distancing's tough. And even though we're smarter and we understand the fundamentals of masks, I still admit every day I admit people that have COVID, people that are resulting in disabilities and deaths. And, you know, this particular week it struck home because one of my dear friends who ran the emergency department in Lubbock, Texas, lost his life this last week to COVID. So healthcare workers are still dying from this disease. And along with that, it's hard to explain to others what the stress is like when every day you go to work and you'll, what I call, swim in the COVID swamp. I think I said last time I talked to you, if you know someone that works in healthcare, a frontline provider, tell them thank you.
Dr. Anderson, are you surprised that we're still here, that we actually are experiencing a third wave? Were you more hopeful throughout the summer months that the messaging from the doctors would get through, that we could get this virus under control? How frustrating is it right now that we are experiencing this?
I think one of the real problems is apathy and emotional exhaustion. We got to a point where we just had to get out, we felt like, and we had to see our friends and our family. And that's one of the things that I want to speak to right now, because we right now are absolutely entering the perfect storm. There's a record number of cases out there right now. That means a record number of people that could give you this disease. And welcome Thanksgiving, a holiday that's built around hugging and making connections with your family that you haven't seen for a while. This is not the time to get careless or lax. I do want to talk about something called stranger bias, because that's the idea that I won't get this from my family. I won't get it from my inner circle. I'm going to get it from a stranger. That's just not true. Most people are asymptomatic with this, especially young folks. They bring it home and give it to mom, and they give it to grandma. And those are the people that get hospitalized and have bad outcomes. We are entering that period of time, Thanksgiving and Christmas, where we're in close proximity, we're indoors. You truly have to be limiting your interactions at home to those people in your households. If you're going to get together, and some people will, try to do it outdoors if it's not pouring rain. Try to stay 6 feet apart. Keep your masks on when you're not eating. Wash your hands. I know this sounds repetitious. It's the same things we've been promoting for 10 months. But seriously, in the next 3 months, it's when it is the most critical for us to try and focus, because 2021 could be much better, but it's up to us.
Dr. Stephen Anderson, thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it.
I can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity to really speak to those people out in the community, because we had the ability, by simply wearing masks and following the simple directions, to bend this curve and actually survive this. We'll win this, but it's not, we're not there yet. We're still 3 to 12 months away from being back to normal.
You can listen to our COVID podcast anytime. Just text COVID, C-O-V-I-D, to 98973. We put one up every week just to keep you as informed as we can on the progress of this infection. You can ring my bell. Ring the bell. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And look. Look who's in Hawaii. It's Rachel Bell, and she's going to tell us how you get tested when you go to Hawaii for the first time since the beginning of the quarantine.
Okay, I would have brought my ukulele in if I knew we were going to have a little sing-along.
Yes,
are you
okay,
playing this live? Wow.
Yeah, I like that.
Oh, I love that.
So what's the story here?
All right, I'll tell you the story. I guess music hour's over. So I believe, you know, according to everything I've read, that Hawaii was the most bullish when it came to really getting a hold of coronavirus. Unlike other states, they said, hey, look, we don't want you coming to Hawaii. If you come in, you have to quarantine for 14 days. When the virus really got going, they were actually paying for people to fly home. They just wanted them out of there. And the result of that was that Hawaii tourism was down at one point 99%, which
Yikes.
Is huge.
That's almost 100.
That you are so good at math and music. Unbelievable.
That's right.
So in mid-October, they actually started welcoming tourists back in, and you can skip the 14-day quarantine as long as you have a negative coronavirus test. And so 100,000 people rushed to the islands, you know, since mid-October, which was only a few weeks ago. So this is how it works. You have to get a coronavirus test within 72 hours of flight. But the interesting thing is, you don't have to show anything at the gate. It's not until you arrive that they check in Hawaii. And I think this has to do with some kind of privacy laws about your medical test. So Hawaiian Airlines is now offering, and you don't have to do it this way, but they're only accepting tests from certain labs so that they know it's legit. So
yeah.
If you happen to be flying from LA or San Francisco, they set up their own labs out there where you can pay $90 to get your results within 36 hours or $150 for day of travel service.
Seriously. So at the airport, or you have to go to a special testing location first?
It's a lab near the airport.
Near the airport.
But you don't have to use those, but they do tell you specific labs you do have to use. So here's how it works. You take a test within 72 hours, no matter where you go to get it. You can upload your results to what they call the Hawaii Safe Travel app. But then when you land, that's when they check. So if you land and you either didn't get a test or you're positive, then you do have to quarantine there, which only for 2 weeks, which I don't understand how this works. If you're positive, wouldn't 2 weeks not even be enough? You could still be sick.
Well, whatever. I mean, how long are you planning on staying in Hawaii? If you quarantine, I mean, if you go on a 3 week vacation, you quarantine for two, have a good time for one, and then come back.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it is kind of self-regulating then, because, you know, it's not like you get to the airport and they turn you around. You could fly all the way there and then be stuck if you didn't, you know, comply with the rules.
Yeah. So I think it would be a good idea to go ahead and get your test long before you plan on going. Right?
Well, you can only do it within 72 hours, because if you do it too long, you know, you could have
got it
again.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this New York Times article was saying that, of course, this is good for airlines and hotels and restaurants, but the locals are not very happy because they feel like they're being put in danger, because the numbers in Hawaii were so much lower than everywhere else. I mean, let's see here. I'm not sure when they did this, but it says, let's see. I guess they had about 15,000 cases, where Florida had 800,000 cases, just to put it in perspective. And so they spoke with this waiter, bartender and waiter in Waikiki, and he said, tourism is terrorism to me right now. I'd ask tourists to stay home if they can. You could test negative, but the virus but get the virus afterward, or you could have it and not realize. Why not skip the vacation for now?
Okay, so let me get this straight then. So the actual people in Hawaii who are hurting because of the 99% decline in tourism do not want the tourists to come back, even though it means they remain unemployed.
Yeah, I mean, of course they didn't speak to everyone, but it seems like a lot of people. And, you know, Hawaii's had this kind of reputation for a long time. You always hear these stories of, you know, surfers not wanting outsiders in their turf. I think because they have an island mentality, they probably do feel protective of themselves. And if they're still getting unemployment, you know, this guy is a server. I'm sure he would rather stay safe and not work and collect unemployment. But they were saying that, you know, Hawaii might be a guinea pig, which was why a lot of the people there aren't really very excited about it, to say this could be a regular part of travel. But it seems like they're leaving it airline to airline. So Hawaiian Airlines is the one that's doing this test thing. But if you flew a different airline, you know, I guess if you did fly a different airline, it would still apply because once you get to Hawaii.
In the article, they were
saying that like different airlines might be adding this testing. Here's the thing that I thought was kind of weird. They were saying, oh, we're just figuring out now that, you know, you can test people and that's how we can make travel safe. What? Like they were doing this in Asia in March.
Well, yeah.
I was so confused why we weren't testing people.
Because we don't want to do anything that isn't developed in America. We don't want to imitate Asia. Thank you, Rachel.
Aloha.
Rachel Bell. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.